Believe it or not, it's good to be home. It's good to be where the heart is. It's good to be here. As you travel around the world, you go to many services. Many are quite lovely, moving. Some, unfortunately, are not. But there's no service like the one with which you're most familiar, which speaks to you on so many different levels. Family, friendship, spiritual. It's a lift to be again part of this service. And now to the business at hand. We're accustomed to approach Israel from west to east. Israel's east. We fly out of New York or Boston. We may fly directly. We may stop in Rome or Paris or London. But the direction is eastward. And there's something in the Jewish experience which associates Jerusalem, Israel, with the east. In the synagogues, there was always a plaque on the wall, usually with the name of God on it, which was called the Mizrach, the eastern plaque, which indicated the direction towards which worship should be directed, towards the temple in Jerusalem. Judah Halevi, the magnificent, romantic poet of the early Middle Ages, spoke one of the first great Zionite hymns, which was part of the heart of our people over the centuries, when he wrote a little poem which begins, Ani b'mizrach v'libi b'sof ma'arav. I am in the west, but my heart is in the depths of the east. And when we come from west to east, we take the trip to Israel very easily. We're accustomed to it. There are no particular problems associated with it. There are no political problems associated with traveling in that direction. This was the first time I'd ever approached Israel from the Far East, coming westward to Israel. It's very different in feel, creates many different kinds of problems. The first thing that you recognize is you can't get from there to Ben Gurion Airport. There's no direct flight from Singapore or Delhi or Bangkok or Bombay to Israel. You have to fly from the Far East to some port in Europe, Athens, Rome, Frankfurt, and then double back to get to Jerusalem. And you begin to recognize when you're in the Far East that the relationships of nations and countries to Israel is very different than it is in the West. When we were in Indonesia, which was our second last major stop, we wanted to send some letters to friends in Jerusalem, telling when we would arrive and where we would be. And the Indonesian post office will not forward mail to Israel. We tend to forget that in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, Islam made another push forward in Southeast Asia and became the dominant religion of Malaysia, of Indonesia, a major force in the Philippines, many of the islands of New Guinea and of that part of the world. And that in the 20th century, these countries have picked up and are part and parcel of the whole political movement of Islam. It isn't simply Arabs against Israelis. It's a question of a whole religious world binding together politically in order to weaken, undo the existence of Israel. When you look at Israel's political relationships in Asia, and you remember that Asia contains more than half of the world's population, and you recognize that Israel has embassies only in a few fringe countries, really, of that part of the world, in Nepal, Thailand, Singapore, the Philippines, Taiwan, and in Japan. And that otherwise, there are no official relationships between those countries, those billions of people, and the state of Israel. You begin to recognize that the assumptions that are so popular, the rather innocent assumptions so popular, increasingly popular in the West, that somehow the intransigent opposition of the Third World and the Arab world to Israel is beginning to break down, to mellow, that they're willing to accept Israel's existence, is not necessarily backed by facts on the ground. When President Herzog of the State of Israel made a state visit to Singapore and the Philippines in late December, early January, Malaysia and Indonesia put great political pressure on the city-state of Singapore to cancel the visit, arguing that as a fellow ASEAN country, Singapore really should bring its foreign policy in line with that of the other policies in the area, which are notably anti-Israeli, often, in Malaysia's case at least, spring over into being purely anti-Semitic. And it's true not only in the countries which have large Muslim populations. India, of course, is predominantly Hindu. India has her own Muslim problems, both externally and domestically. She has Pakistan on her northwestern border. She has Bangladesh on her northeastern border. She has a constant series of small bore street riots between Muslims and Hindus in the center of her cities. And yet from 1948 to this day, India has refused to recognize the State of Israel. India, as a leader of the non-aligned nations, had taken a very hard line opposing Israel's attempts to become part of various international bodies. India has refused to allow Israeli citizens to take part in international conferences in India. She has refused to allow Israeli sports people to take part in competition in India. And at the moment, she is hoisted on a delightful petard because among her other serious problems, the Sikhs in the Punjab, problems with Pakistan, problems of poverty, problems of devolution in other parts of the country, the Israeli tennis team, of all things, surprised the Czechoslovakian tennis team and won in the first round of the Davis Cup this year. And of such things, international problems are made. Because according to the luck of the draw, Israel must play India in the second round, and the match is scheduled for India. India has consistently refused to allow Israeli athletes to enter the country. If she refuses to allow the Israelis to compete, she must forfeit her chances at the Davis Cup. And not only does she forfeit her chances in this year's competition, but apparently she will be banned from competition for several years to come. I must say that I have no sympathy for Rajiv Gandhi in this area, and something I'm sure will be arranged. But it's enough to remind us again that when you come from Asia to Israel, you recognize that ostracism, the embargo, all of that are still very much in place. And we had a very dramatic evidence of this on our flight from Singapore to Athens. The plane puts down in a place called Dubai, one of those little pinpoints in the edge of the oil map of the Arabian Peninsula. And when we put down there, largely for refueling, the plane developed radar problems, could not continue. And we had to wait till another plane was sent by Singapore Airlines to Dubai to pick us up and to continue on the trip. People on the plane were allowed off the plane. They were allowed to leave the airport to visit in Dubai if there's anything to see there that was worth seeing. But very sheepishly, the people who are the officials of Singapore Air announced that anybody who had an Israeli passport, or anybody who had, in fact, any passport, which had in it a visa, which was allowed you, which indicated that you'd once visited Israel, would not be allowed to leave the transit area of the airport. And we were there for over half a day. And there was this very clear division between people who had visited Israel or Israelis and the rest of the plains population. So you come to Israel when you come from Asia, convinced that many of the hopes that have been expressed by columnists and pundits in the world, that the intransigence of the Arab world is breaking down, that the Third World is beginning to have second doubts, about what Israel really represents, that you have to take that to a large degree with a grain of salt. The evidence on the ground, at least as you come in this direction, is not there. And since I'm really going to try and do this morning's talk with you as a series of incidents of revisiting Israel, let my second bit of a vignette be also about our air travel. We went to Athens. It seemed the nearest port to Israel. We went despite the advice of a number of our friends in Asia, well-intentioned advice that Athens was a notoriously insecure airport. We probably would be safer if we went to Rome or Frankfurt. I wasn't quite sure. There have been incidents in all of those airports. But I was sure that since we were flying El Al from Athens to Israel, we would be safe. There would be security. We were told to appear at the airport several hours ahead of time for security clearance. I deliberately left our luggage unlocked so that they could look through everything and make sure that we were not about to become terrorists on the plane. We got to the airport in good time. We rolled the little wagon with our baggage up to the Israeli check-in counter. A woman came out, smiling, very pleasant. She asked us several innocuous questions, and within literally 2 minutes, our bags never having been examined nor opened, they were checked through to Israel. We thought to ourselves, well, at least when we get inside the transit area and we're asked to go into the very special area which now exists in the Athens airport from which Israeli planes depart every day, there'll be a close check of our hand baggage, the things we're carrying aboard. We had a lot more time than we expected in the transit lounge. Finally, the plane was called. We went to this special area, and there was no more security there than there would be at the Cleveland Airport if you're going to Detroit or New York. Our bags were never opened. We were never frisked. There was no kind of security of any consequence. And I tried to understand what was involved. The best I could do was to feel that these Israeli security people, and there were a lot of them around, were tired. Perhaps you put it, you might call it battle fatigue. They'd been doing this for months and for years. Most of them had, I think, come to feel that they had good judgment, which allowed them not to go through the time-consuming procedures which are prescribed. If they could look me in the eye and know that I was a domesticated Cleveland rabbi and not a terrorist. But it's carelessness. And when you get tired and when you've been at it too long, there's a lack of judgment. A lack of judgment which can have very, very serious, obvious, serious consequences. The thing I came to Israel with and left Israel with is that it's a country desperately in need of a vacation. It's a country where people have been under the gun for too long. And therefore, they have become a little bit careless. They're certainly tired and have every reason to be. And they're beginning to make a series of very serious judgmental mistakes. And you see these mistakes primarily on the political level. But you find them also at all levels throughout the country. When you see some little things. Maya Rosen, as you know, has been the ambassador of Israel to Washington for the past several years. His normal tour of duty was to end sometime in March of this year. And he received a letter from the foreign ministry to this effect. Subsequently, he was to receive three other letters from the foreign ministry, prolonging his stay in Washington by 2 weeks, but then by 3 weeks, then by another number of weeks, and he's still there. Now, it was publicly announced that he had been relieved of duty. The relationships at this point in time, as in most points of time, between Washington and Jerusalem are critical. You're dealing with Iran Gate, you're dealing with the Pollard affair, you're dealing with the foreign affairs budget and the whole question of foreign aid. You're dealing with a whole variety of issues, Soviet emigration of refuseniks and others. And yet here is a man who has obviously been labeled a lame duck, who Israel needs somebody in place who can go into these negotiations at all levels and be the point person who has been part of all of them and can carry them along and report exactly the changes that have taken place in Israel's position. But that's not to be. Now, what happened? What's the issue? The issue might be that his successor had some personal problems, health problems or otherwise, but that's not the case. The issue is that this coalition government of Mr. Shamir and Mr. Peres is in shambles in many ways, that according to the ministerial setup of the Israeli government, it is the foreign minister who appoints ambassadors, with the prime minister having the right of advice and consent. And it is the prime minister who appoints senior officials in the foreign ministry, with the foreign minister having the right of advice and consent. Now you can tell what's happened. Mr. Peres wants one of his own in Washington. Mr. Shamir is not about to allow that to happen. Mr. Shamir wants one of his own as a senior official in the foreign ministry. And Mr. Peres is not about to allow that to happen. Two tired men who've been at the business of government, of governance, for far too long, almost two decades, who have lost sight, because of that, of the larger issue, that Israel needs somebody who is respected and in place and empowered in Washington, not somebody who's being pulled back every 2 weeks, told to pack his bags, and then told to unpack his bags. And it's all at a standstill, because these two men are at political loggerheads. The larger issue has been forgotten in the narrower issue. You see it again in intemperate speech, lack of judgment. As you know, there's been a whole discussion over the last weeks, some very serious political discussions with the Soviet Union, conducted not only by Israelis, but by our own Secretary Shultz, on the possibilities of bringing out sizable numbers of the refuseniks and of others from the Soviet Union. And one of the issues that has somehow been caught up is this, is whether they must go to Israel or they can be allowed, as in the past, to choose to come to the United States or elsewhere. One can have one opinion or the other, but the major issue is to get these people out. That's the human issue. And if Zionist ideologues and others want to fight out the issue of where they're to go, you do it privately. But Mr. Shamir, 3 weeks ago, got up at a public meeting, and he said flat out, if these people do not come to Israel, this migration has no meaning for us. You don't talk that way. If you have judgment, if you're not tired, if you've not been at it so long that you forget that what you say has consequences. The general impression I had in Israel, I think the general impression of the Israelis with whom we spoke, is that this present government, like these few security guards we saw in Athens, is tired, fatigued, battle-weary, been at it too long, and lacks judgment because of that. And you see that in a whole variety of ways. I was asked mostly in Israel about the Demjanjuk affair, largely because it was Cleveland. And there were a number of articles which appeared, one lead article in the International Herald Tribune, about Ukrainians and Jews being at loggerhead in Cleveland and what did it mean. That aside, as you begin to think back over the Demjanjuk trial, not here in the United States, but in Israel, and if you ask the Israelis, why did they decide to have this trial? You find that nobody has a very good answer. It's clear that the Israelis, the government, because it was a governmental decision, decided that it was time to have a show trial about the Holocaust, about the Shoah. Why? Apparently because many felt, rightly or wrongly, that a whole generation of young people had grown up since the Second World War for whom the Holocaust was a movie, for whom it was ancient history as the Cossack Khmelnytsky depredations against Jews 300 years ago or the Inquisition. And they wanted to bring the truth of the Holocaust alive to this younger generation. And you can see this reasoning in the way the trial was set up. It does not take place in a normal courtroom in one of the established courts in Israel. It takes place in the Binyanei HaUmah, the great conference center in Jerusalem, where international meetings of all kinds take place. It was open to the television cameras in a conference room which can seat hundreds. It's broadcast daily, both on radio and on television. And it's clear that the Israeli government hoped to revive the reality of the Holocaust for its younger citizens, and its older citizens as well, and perhaps also for the world. Now, I confess that I have a congenital dislike of show trials. I don't like them. A trial is a trial. I know that there are times when a show trial is necessary, when the issues are overwhelming and affect the whole world, when they're larger than the individuals in the docket. Nuremberg was such a trial. The Eichmann trial was such a trial, because Eichmann represented the policy of genocide. He was the man who organized and engineered it. You can make the case. But if you'd looked at Demjanjuk carefully, the issue was not the Holocaust. He was not part of the foreign ministry of the Nazi regime. He was not in Eichmann's office. His crime is to have been a sadistic, cruel guard someplace way down the line in one of the minor concentration camps. And he was a brute and he was an animal. But you can't make the Holocaust the central issue in a trial which involves a man so far down the line. And that's, in fact, what's happened. Nobody on the defense has denied the Holocaust, or Nazi atrocities, or genocide. The issue has focused narrowly, as it must in a court case, on one issue. Is this man the man the American courts have declared him to be? Or is he, as his defense lawyer claims, simply somebody else? Somebody who has been, unfortunately, misidentified. And so day after day, the Israeli papers and the radio and television report long sessions of the court dealing with such issues as whether or not a particular handwriting expert is competent to give testimony as an expert. They took 2 days on that issue. There are long, long, intricate debates on whether or not a particular document in Russian or Polish or German has been translated correctly into English and into Hebrew. There are long debates as to whether a particular picture can be accepted as evidence or not. There are long debates as to whether one can accept the documents from the Russian archives because Russia is known to have been guilty of disinformation. And the whole trial has become something other than it was intended to be. And at the end of the trial, it's very clear now that Israel will have a very difficult decision as to what the punishment shall be, because this man is clearly a low-level type, and there clearly will become a spate of books written by those who make money off this kind of thing, proving that he was railroaded, that he was not the Ivan the Terrible. I believe that the American courts proved that he was, beyond a shadow of a doubt. But you, on evidence of this kind, you can always make the other case. And it will be made because people will make money off of it, and large segments of the community will want to believe it, and Israel's justice system will be held up for suspicion. And there will be precisely enough suspicion of Israeli justice simply in the fact that this was handled as a show trial rather than simply as a trial of a single individual. As you look at it with hindsight, whoever made the decision to accept Eichmann, once the United States had extradited him, and Israel did not have to accept him, made a terrible error of judgment. And did so, I think, because of tiredness, because they are fixated on old problems rather than trying to handle new ones, the real ones, because they're living in the past rather than in the present. They can't make up their minds about the present, so it's easier to deal with the past. 10 days ago, the foreign minister, Mr. Perez, went to Spain. In January of 1986, the Spanish government finally established political relationships, diplomatic relationships with Israel. And this was the first visit by a Spanish, by an Israeli foreign minister to Spain since that time. And he spent his time talking to Senor Gonzalez, the foreign minister, about his pet interest in it, creating the possibility of an international conference on peace in the Middle East. A day later, the Prime Minister of Israel sent a letter to Senor Gonzalez saying that it was a stated position of the Israeli government that they were opposed to an international conference on peace in the Middle East, and that they felt that this would be counterproductive to peace, move the countries away from arrangements rather than towards them. And understandably, Mr. Gonzalez got up before a press conference the very next day and said, in effect, it's very hard to understand what the Israeli government has in mind. Simcha Dinitz, who many of you have heard and met, you remember was the Israeli ambassador to the United States, was quoted in the papers while we were there. A group of conference of some kind or other asked him, could you make clear to us the nature of Israel's position as far as an international peace conference is concerned? And he smiled sweetly and he said, no, I can't. We can't operate a government that way. A government, first of all, has to have a united voice. Israel's coalition government does not have a united voice. There has to be a vision which the country can, to a degree, rally behind. And Israel is a very divided country on the question of territory and peace conference, and the government's not giving it any leadership. You see this lack of judgment and this tiredness in so many ways. The Pollard affair, I understand, has united American Jewry in the feeling that from beginning to end it was a disaster of judgment and of planning by Israel. Most Israelis are not quite convinced that that is entirely true. They do not agree at the charge that it was necessarily a miscalculation and a misjudgment that Israel should engage in certain kinds of spying activity on the United States. Their argument runs to the fact that all countries spy on all other countries. England spying on the United States spies on England. They ask, why is it that if America is, as she claims to be, such a close ally to the United States, so much of the material that Pollard delivered to the Israelis had to do with information which directly affected the security of Israel. Information as to the meetings and the plans of the PLO, information as to the shipment of missiles and guns from the Soviet Union to Syria, the timing, the numbers, information as to the quality of the arms and the ways in which the arms might be defended against, that America had this kind of information and had not passed it on to Israel, and that every country in this jungle called international relationships has the right to go after any information which makes its security more certain, more secure. Now, you may accept that rationalization, that reasoning, or you may reject it. But having said that, the Israelis I met are unanimous in condemning the judgment of their government on the way the affair was handled once it broke out into the open. Why, they ask, did the Israeli government not return immediately all of the documents which had been taken? America has copies, the originals of all of those documents. They were not keeping anything from the American government, but they made an issue. They've returned only about a third of them. Why didn't they return all of them? Why did they deliberately promote their Air Force general, who had been the master mind of Pollard, when they knew this would inflame anger in the United States? It was a totally egregious action, totally unnecessary. And why didn't they make it clear to America, through diplomatic and other channels, that no one has the right to investigate, no legislative body, no judicial body of another country, to investigate the operations of the CIA, the Shin Bet, the secret services of another country? These are sacrosanct. that America has no right to assume that an investigative body could necessarily go into those areas, but that Israel would accept whatever seemed legitimate as to information required by the United States for her prosecutions, and would conduct that investigation with due dispatch and honesty. More or less, they took that second position, though they never made the rationale clear. But unfortunately, the commission that they appointed, headed by Abba Eban, has been lethargic in the extreme. For 2 weeks while we were in Israel, 7 of the 8 members of the commission were out of the country, including its chairman, Mr. Eban, who was very busy here in the United States promoting a rerun of his Heritage series. And the American government was getting angrier and angrier about delay and all that kind of thing. And so the Israelis agree with American Jews that the handling of the fallout from the Pollard affair was disastrous, that Israel did not make its positions clear, that the American government assumes a proprietary right in Israel, which she has no right to assume, and the Israelis, because they are either afraid of to responding or not, very rarely stand up and say, thus far shall you go and no further. I don't know if you saw the other day, when Vice President Bush was in Israel, he went to pay a courtesy call on President Herzog. And he tried to send ahead his security people to investigate the president's office to make sure that it was safe. And Herzog finally said to the vice president or to his ambassador, when we go to Washington, we don't send Israeli agents into the White House to make sure that the White House is secure. There are normal diplomatic courtesies which you extended between state and state. And America has no right to assume, despite our close relationship, that she can't intrude into our most private affairs simply because she is stronger or more arrogant or what have you. Israelis want a change. They know they can't take a vacation. They know that things are heating up on their northern border. While we were in Israel, the first Katyusha landed in Israel proper in the last 7 years. The first guerrillas cut through the border fence at Israel's border, not the border fence a few miles into Lebanon, penetrated Israel. They were shot, but they managed to penetrate. It's clear that the Syrian movement into the Lebanon has forced these terrorist groups south, and to justify themselves, they're going to have to increase their level of military action against Israel. Israel can't take a vacation, but the Israelis desperately want to change. They want to be relieved of the tired old men who have been running the government, whose judgments they no longer trust, those who are battle fatigued. And that includes Shamir, and that includes Peres, and that includes Rabin. They want a clean slate, and they haven't the faintest idea how to achieve it. The coalition government will fall. But what next? The same kind of government, either of Labor or of Likud, with the swing group being still in the hands of the ultra-Orthodox. Why? Because the political system in Israel guarantees that kind of result. The parties are two major parties are simply too evenly balanced. And so what you find in the Israeli press are all kinds of proposals for electoral reform. Some way to get new faces, new parties into the game, a new vision. The most popular of these propositions has to do with taking 80 of the 120 seats of the Knesset. All seats are now elected at large, and having these 80 seats divided regionally so that local politicians who have their own groups who support them can be elected, can build up followings, and ultimately achieve power. I don't know if that's the best system or not the best system, but at this point, Israelis would love any kind of change in the system. And it's most unlikely that that kind of system will, in fact, become into being. Just as it is unlikely that Cuyahoga County will ever have a single true county government. There are too many vested interests in the present system. The old men won't give up. And those who have paid their dues for 30 years and will be the next old men aren't about to give up their seats. And so you have this built-in inertia, political inertia, which leaves Israel without a unified political vision, splitting more and more into warring camps over issues, territories, non-territories, religious domination of the country, non-religious freedom, civil rights, and the like. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that Israel is a disaster area. It is not. The Israeli economy is stronger than it has been in a long, long time. Inflation is as much under control in Israel as it is in the United States. The new shekel is fairly strong. Israel's foreign reserves are the highest they've been in over 30 years, $4.3 billion. $500 million of capital investment were made in Israel in the first quarter of this last year. They estimate that the gross national product this year will increase by 5%, which is a very healthy increase. And so you have a sense that the economic problems have been faced, and that was the original reason for creating the coalition government. That at least has happened. But you also recognize it has happened as it will happen ultimately as in the United States, at a cost. Israel is paying the cost. We haven't begun to pay the cost. And that cost has to do with an austerity budget, which hits particularly at education, social welfare, the integration of new immigrants, hospitals, medical care, and the like. As an example, this coming year, the Hebrew University is going to have to release 800 senior people, 500 staff, and 300 faculty people. And that means not only for a university that a lot of individuals are going to suffer, but that for years there'll be no new appointment from below, because there's no place in the university for these people. Whole departments will disappear. And they're talking about increasing tuition costs for students to the university from their present about $1,300 to $2,000. Now, for an American parent who's paying Ivy League tuitions, that sounds like very little money. But for an Israeli family where the median income is much, much lower than here, where dollars are not easy to come by, it's a great deal of money. And there were student strikes while we were in Israel. And one of the other consequences of this kind of activity is that the attempt to bring the other Israel, the majority Israel, the Oriental Israel, into the mainstream will be held back, because it's precisely those families who have the least money and the least ability to send their children to the universities. There have been cutbacks in all of these areas of service, austerity, in order to try and handle the economic problems. The world is going through certain kinds of structural changes as far as the economy is concerned. Israel is a little further along in it than we are. But the problems are real, and jobs are not easy to come by. And some of the Yerida, which is happening now, is happening among groups who would not normally come to America or to England. It's coming because it's the only way trained people with skills can find jobs. There are no jobs in many, many of the disciplines in which young people are being trained, and trained well, by the Israeli universities. Jerusalem is a joy. We came to Jerusalem in the spring. The weather was glorious. We were given an apartment which looked out with a view over the whole wall of the old city. The sun was out. Teddy Kollek's parks have now coalesced together, and there's a sense of green and flowers of natural beauty as well as of the old city. The redo of the Jewish quarter of the old city is complete, and it's a very effective piece of architecture. The old city is clean. It's a joy to behold. And so there is a sense of change for the better, a sense of a lot that's very good that is happening. And there's also a sense that the problems which Israel faces now are political, and because they're political, they're manageable. If the problems were otherwise, perhaps they would not be tractable. But politicians can be gotten rid of. And as much as I respect, I've known some of these men and respect them, there's a time for a change, and that time has come. We went to Seder in a way I've never been to Seder before. It was about 8 o'clock at night, full moon, stars sparkling in the sky. We walked to Seder, and we walked along the street that is on the other side of the hill, which looks out at the walls of the old city. The moon is shining down on the Judean hills. The city is quiet. The only people you see are others who have their Haggadahs in hand and are walking to their friend's house for Seder. And you have that sense which is unique to Jerusalem, unique to Israel, of something which is eternal. That somehow you are participating in a holiday of deliverance which had been celebrated in that city at least since the 10th century before the Common Era, for at least 3,000 years, and that it would be celebrated there for another 3,000. And that, I guess, is the shot in the arm, the adrenaline, the spiritual adrenaline, which being in Israel provides you. It's not only the Seder, lovely, warm, intimate, the service. It's the setting. It's the place. I don't know how long Jews will be in Cleveland. I was in many places in Asia which had had Jewish communities, and they were no longer. But I am absolutely convinced that the promise of God in our scripture, seen throughout our history, is true. That year in and year out, Jews will be able to say, L'shana haba, Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. And some of you will have the great pleasure, I hope, of being there, L'shana haba, next year, for Pesach. It's a wonderful time. Amen.